Hello, Bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 72 of Little Things for Bonsai People. It is 2024, the year of the wood dragon, and this time I am joined by a very special guest. I have Byron Myrick of Myrick Bonsai Pottery joining me today. How's it going, Byron?
It's going good, Evan. How are you?
I'm excellent. Feeling a lot better than I did yesterday when I arrived in Texas to teach some lectures and demos over here, because I was very road weary. But at the time of recording, I've recovered and actually having a pretty good time over here. So
yeah,
doing pretty good.
Yeah.
And so I figured I'd bring you back on. I know if anyone's been following Underhill's content for a while, and I've had a couple people tell me that they've watched the video. We had a YouTube video a while back where I interviewed you. I sat down in your ceramic shop and we talked shop with you a while back. You remember that?
Yeah, it's been a few years.
Yeah, it's been a minute. And the audio and the video on that it was kind of looked like it was shot with a potato.
Yeah.
So I figured it was time to do a revisit.
So. Yeah, it's been a while, and I'm sure your technique and all is a lot better than it was then. You were just beginning.
Yep, just getting into the creating content and making stuff that people can actually enjoy. But yeah, I'll be talking to Byron about his history in bonsai ceramics and his history in ceramics in general, and then we can get into some technical stuff about firing processes and all the other stuff that you do to basically create pottery that beautifully complements bonsai. If people are familiar with the show, I'm sure you've heard me drop Byron's name quite a few times. He is one of my favorite potters. I use his ceramics for a lot of my show trees because his pots are high quality. They're very good for that. So, before I get into that, though, do need to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our patrons over at patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. Head on over there and become a Bonsai Best Bud and support our show and hang out in the Discord and talk with these amazing people. I don't have any brand new Bonsai Best Buds since last recording. It's only been literally a day. So I'm just going to do the featured Best Bud is going to be Chase Pertweet. It's one of my best guys, one of my best dudes, stood in my wedding. Thank you, Chase, for sponsoring the show and being a good friend. And of course, we have our podcast sponsor, Joshua Roth Tools. Thank you, John, with Joshua Roth, for supporting our show and giving us awesome giveaways, which I will be doing a giveaway later this week. I think I might go ahead and do it right before this episode drops. So someone's gonna have a Joshua Roth tool, and we also got some also have a few little accents. Side stand, like the little not a Diaza, a Jita. I have some Jitas that JM Stewart Woodworking gave me to also give away as well. So there's gonna be some cool stuff. And then also I have to mention, without going much further, Matt O'Donnell. He's our editor. He makes us sound smart, cleans up our audio, makes us enjoyable to listen to. You go over to mattodonnell.com, fill out a contact form to start your own podcast show or audio engineering project with him. He's a set bassist living in Nashville, Tennessee. He's an all-around awesome guy. It's in the script. I say it every single time. And like I said on the previous episode, and I'll keep kind of shouting it out for Matt, go check out Matt O'Donnell Wants to Know. It's his own podcast show that he started recently where he talks to people that have unique career paths and how they the eclectic careers or, you know, careers that you just wouldn't normally assume would be something that you could do. So yeah, it's a good show. And one of my favorite podcast shows before I got serious about bonsai, like I am now working at the nursery, I actually did listen to another similar type show where somebody would talk to people in the music industry, and Matt kind of does the same thing with that. So it's pretty cool. Byron.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, welcome to the show. I know, like we said earlier, I feel like it's been a long time coming to get you back on and get some clean audio with you on here. So tell everybody what you've been up to recently.
Just getting ready for a couple of shows coming up. Got Houston coming up at the end of April, and then following directly on the heels of that, St. Louis the next week. And evening at both of those. And so just cranking out pots. Got a few scattered late orders in, you know, people trying to repot last minute and get a few of those out as well. So been busy.
Yeah, I imagine. Because like I spoke with another potter on the show not too long ago with Tori Solis, where we were talking about the process and how long it takes and the throwing and the drying and then the some of the hand building processes.
Yeah.
And I can imagine people pushing to do repots, especially whenever your time frame is so limited.
Yeah. And I got to throw in also your event coming up in a couple of weeks there Folsom.
Yep. I'm sure if people have been listening.
Well.
Yeah. Save Bonsai 2024 is going to be at the time of this episode's launch, it'll be like next week. So, and that just to fill you guys in real quick, if you guys are not familiar, if you haven't listened to a lot of the episodes before this, Say Bonsai is going to be, it's going to be a show that I hope I can run every other year. If I run it every year, great, but I think every other year is more realistic. And that's kind of how most bonsai shows are run. And we're going to have live crawfish and gumbo and have a bonsai show and have amazing vendors out there, including Byron. I'm willing to bet that you're going to have some newer pieces ready for this show, right?
Yeah. That's I got a firing cooling off now that hope to get some gems out of.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a good question. Kind of start off a little bit too is like if you're preparing for a show like say Bonsai. I know it's not a big show per se, but it is a chance to get exposure to your works. And so when you're prepping for a show like this, what does that usually like look like? Is there a lot going into it, or how do you feel usually going into a show like that?
I kind of, you know, look at the calendar, and in my mind I'm not organized enough to write it down, but I kind of set a date as to, okay, if I'm making stuff, I've got to be finished with it by this point in time. And then that gives me a target to reach to get things so that I can get them dry and fired and then glazed and fired again and then, you know, priced and packed up before I have to leave. So sometimes it's, I'm pushing it where it's just I'm pulling it out of the kiln, putting it in a box and leaving it the next day. I don't like to push it that close, but unfortunately it happens that way sometimes. But it's kind of a mental game of scheduling to get it all organized and they are in one piece, so to speak.
Do you ever pull pots out of the kiln and they're still like kiln warm by the time you get to the event? They're kind of still kind of got that touch to them.
No, they cool faster than that, but I don't like to pull things out. I had a teacher said if you can hold it in your hand, it's cool enough to take out. If you can't hold it in your hand, don't take it out. And that's kind of my guideline. So you know, anything less than 100 degrees, it's pretty safe to take out of the kiln. But, sometimes it's close. But
and as far as, I threw ceramics and I had the opportunity to work with some nice kilns and stuff whenever I was in college. And I remember, when you take them out, they are pretty warm to the touch. Scalding if you really crack it open too early. And it's kind of this weird thing where like you can feel the heat in the clay body still when you take it out and you're like, oh, that's not too hot, but it seems like the longer you hold it, the more it just starts to transfer to the point where it could burn the crap out of you and burn your fingerprint off. It just feels about but like you also can't crack those kilns so too quick because also that sudden change of temperature will cause stuff to just fissure, crack that you can't even really see, and you can hear the crackling noise.
Get some cracking going on if you cool it too fast, and You don't want that to happen. So, yeah, kind of an, you know, it takes almost as twice as long to cool down as it does to heat up. So that's kind of a good way to think about it as well. If it takes 12 hours to heat it up, fire it, then you ought to give it 24 at least to cool down before you begin to think about taking it out. I'm not above peeking in and seeing what something looks at or looks like at 300 degrees or whatever, but I just take a quick peek and close it back up and wait for it down around 100 or so before I take it out.
You see, I know you've been doing ceramics for so long now. Actually, we do need to revisit that conversation. How long you been doing ceramics, real quick?
A long time. I started taking ceramics when I was in college. I was an art major and was seeking another direction, but found clay as an elective class, which you had to have so many elective hours and things that weren't your discipline. And painting was my discipline at the time, but I took a pottery class and then I just, you know, it felt so natural and something that that I wanted to keep pursuing. So anyway, that's when I began. I taught for 30 years at a community college and junior college system here in the state. Some of them call themselves junior college, some of them call themselves community colleges, but anyway, there's like 13 of them in the state. I was part of that system and taught there for 30 years and then retired and continued. I have a shop at my house, which you've been to, and so I'm in it working every day, continuing making pots. So I guess in the long run, you could probably say 50 years or so that I've been making pots.
That's a lifetime in making pots now.
Yeah, that's a lot of clay.
Yeah. If you had to guess,
I have no idea.
How many pounds do you think you've gone
pounds.
Through?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I just ordered. In fact, I got to go pick it up today after we finish this. Two tons.
What does that even look like?
Yeah, it's a lot of pots of the clay.
Yeah, that's insane.
So, I have no idea pots or tonnage, but if I go through, you know, probably a ton a year at least.
Wow. And when you pick up that those tons like that, I'm guessing your truck is enough, or do you have to pull a trailer?
Oh, no, I have a trailer. And in fact, I have to go. I'm fortunate enough that I have a supplier that is only about 5 miles from me. They don't make the clay. They just they make another product that a clay supplier buys from them. And so when they take their product to that supplier, they bring me back my order. And then I go pick it up from them. And they're only about 5 miles away, like I said. And so I take my trailer over there. They put a pallet on there, which is basically a ton. And I bring it home and then go back and get another ton. It's not, my trailer is not even rated, I don't think, for 2 tons. I wouldn't want to try it anyway.
We do have a company over here in Baton Rouge. I'm sure you've heard of them. Years you've been in clay, Alligator Clay Company.
Right.
And they've got excellent clay bodies and a good selection.
Yeah, I use some of their product, yes, definitely.
So it's a whole different world getting into ceramics as a career. And you had taught ceramics for 30 years. And so it's just interesting to know that there's whole warehouses for this kind of thing and the glazes are always also specialized and there's all kinds of different things you could do with that. And if people would go on and look at your work, if they Google Byron Myrick Pottery, and I know your pottery has gotten to this point now where if you look up like American Bonsai Potters, there's like a website or something where they'll have like little galleries and stuff. You can see some pieces that you've done. and all your different glazing techniques. I think they're even better now than some of the stuff that I've seen listed online in reference to your work. And I love some of the stuff that you've been doing, like that, like, you know, my favorite one, that big pot that you made for me like a year or so back, that ash glaze that drips pink. And so all that stuff's so awesome. But like, give us a rundown of like how you got into experimenting with glazing like that. Was that something that was like a bunch of happy accidents or?
No, well, when I was in school, that's the way we did it. We didn't use commercial glazes. We mixed our glazes. That was part of the educational process, that you had to mix your own glazes. And so when I started teaching, that's what I continued to do. We mixed everything, and you just find formulas, do research, look in books, look there, you know, there's some classic formulas of different types of glazes, whether it's a wood ash glaze or a pheno glaze or, you know, whatever, and you just start experimenting with it. And they don't always work the first time, and some of them don't, you know, work with your clay body and things like that. You have to experiment and evolve, and that's the secret there, is just continuing to kind of push. And that's what I do. Every time I fire, I like to have something in the kiln that I haven't done before and with the glaze, you know, a combination of two together, one over the other, or, you know, vice versa, change them around. Maybe it works good one way. Let's see how it works the other way. Things right, like that. They're not drastic changes all the time or always brand new glazes that I'm trying. They're subtle changes of how much I put on there or how much I put it one over the other, things like that. And so you find those things, you know, occasionally. Sometimes they work, like I said, sometimes they don't work. And then when they do, it's like, oh, we need to write this down or remember that one.
Yeah.
And so that, I don't know if that answered your question or not, but anyway.
No, that's good. I mean, do you find yourself writing down recipes often, or do you kind of like put these things to memory?
Oh, I've got them, you know, the ones I use, I've got them written down. I've got my books that I've had for years that I add to, and sometimes I don't usually take one out. I may, you know, remove a star or two from it, but you know, if it works really good, I put an asterisk on it or make a little footnote or something. Mm-hmm. And as to what glaze or clay body it works good on, things like that. And yeah, if I lost my book, I'd be in bad shape.
That's a recorded history of all your experiments and stuff.
Yeah.
And I guess there's some secret Byron Myrick recipes in there, right?
Oh, well, some of them, you know, they even have another potter's name on there, you know, that I found it in his book or an article they had written or whatever. But and then some of them that are just things that I've come up with and changed, you know, you would be hard put if, you know, somebody picking it up and reading it, knowing what my codes mean.
Do you have a cipher for yourself?
Well, it's just like I have one called RGB, and then, you know, somebody would look at that and they was, what does that mean? But actually it was a guy's name.
So you familiarize yourself with, like you said, with like reference to other potters or other techniques you've seen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that's a cool way to look at it. It's kind of like the way that a lot of people don't really think about this too often, about like how an analytical minded person versus like more of a expressionistic type processes go, as far as relating to things as opposed to like numbers, like hard numbers and stuff. But ceramics does take you back in that direction of having hard numbers on
on the formulas. You'll see that, you know, they're very mine are written out in grams. And so, you know, I have a gram scale, and you got to, when you're measuring the glaze or components for a glaze out, you have to rely on those numbers and be hard fast to them to get the same results every time. Not that you always will, because some of the components change sometimes. That's another factor that is kind of out of your hands when they're mining this stuff, that, you know, they change location sometime, and there's minute changes a little bit to the feldspar or the lithium or whatever it is you're putting in there that can change, throw it off a little bit.
Yeah, that's something I've never really considered. I mean, I don't deal with glazing enough to think about those considerations. And honestly, like, I suck at, like, analyzing how to glaze pieces that I've made in the recent past, where I'm just like, all right, well, I guess I'll just put this Shino glaze on there and then hope for the best that it doesn't stick to the kiln furniture. Is usually what I'm worried about. But with your amount of experience, then you have to actually start thinking about how the materials have been affected. Like you said, then that is really interesting that, like, it could even change, like, little subtle things, like where the quality of the stuff that's been mined for what you're mixing in your glazes. And have you seen any shifts in stuff like that, or does it feel like it's always kind of been the same, or are things different?
Oh, things are definitely different. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, in components, you know, they'll quit mining a particular material just because it's, you know, becomes commercially, you know, not worth it. There used to be a component, and, you know, kind of nerding out here, but there used to be a component called Albany slip, which a lot of people used in glaze, which was just a natural clay, but it had a high iron content, and a lot of people used it in certain glazes. And a few years ago, they just quit mining it and shut the mine down. Now, you can kind of make some yourself now, but there's still some clays out there that are kind of close, so you can take those and add a few components to it and get basically the same results. But that's just an example. But I've had colors change on me to some extent. I used to mix a glaze that I could put over another glaze and get a nice, really nice light blue. And I can't get that anymore. It's something has changed about it, and I can't figure it out. It doesn't work anymore.
I do have an oval that I got from you a while back. It is like a really nice baby blue, and you put it on a porcelain body as well. Is that the same glaze?
Is it about? Is it a gloss or is it a matte glaze? Do you remember?
Ooh, that's a good question. If I was at my house, I would go take a quick peek, but it's got a little ginkgo planting in it that I put out there for Kate. And if I remember right, it's not very gloss. It's like matte, but there's a little bit of a gloss, just slight, ever slightly.
The one I'm speaking of is a matte, the one that changed on me.
Mm-hmm.
So if it is a gloss, that's a different glaze. But
okay.
Yeah. If it is a matte, then that's the glaze that I can't get back.
Seem
to get more.
Yeah. Because there's a couple of glazes that every once in a while I'll see your pots and, like, and you're right, like, you'll do something where you'll experiment and something different will happen. And you got that really rich, like, purple matte glaze recently that I love that glaze. That glaze is so crazy looking. It feels so deep in tone for that glaze.
Yeah.
And was that kind of experimenting, or is that kind of...
Well, that came about as someone had asked for a really dark black matte glaze. And so I experimented with that and was successful with it. And I took the you can take the base glaze And, you know, it's like making cakes. If you want to put chocolate in it, you make a cake and you put chocolate syrup in it or flavoring or powder or whatever. In glazes, if you want to make it black, you might put a combination of different chemicals. If you want blue, you put cobalt in it. So I took that black glaze body without the black coloring in it, and I tried it with the blue and came up with that glaze. And I've tried it with different percentages, but that percentage seems to work the best. Don't okay. ask me why. I can't remember off the top of my head what percentage of cobalt is in that. But yeah. Anyway, it came up with that really rich, rich blue there that I like that too. It, yeah, I can imagine a nice ginkgo in the fall and a pot with that, with all the yellow leaves on it. That's kind of what it, in my mind, I see when I think of that color.
Yeah. Some of the glazes are so flexible and they're so easy to match and complement many aspects of like bonsai as far as like the fall color on trees or flowering plants. Like I've got like I've got a soft kind of rectangle that I got from you very recently. It has that deep blue purpley color, and I put violas in it, and it's just, yeah. It pops. It looks so good.
Yeah.
I'll probably be showing it at say bonsai as an accent kusamono to one of the trees, or it might stand alone. It just looks that good. I just hope that my violas continue to flower for me in a couple of yeah. weeks, because I think they're at peak right now.
Yeah.
This spring. But that was something I was going to say. I was going to mention a little earlier. I heard you mention like kind of nerding out on certain things that are not available anymore. And I mean, I'm sure it might come up in pottery like circles and stuff, like where people will find something like an old glaze or an old clay body. And is that collectible to you guys? Like when y'all see that, would you just grab it and hold on to it just because you want to have it, or you might use it for like a special occasion one day when you create something?
You mean like a chemical or something?
Yeah, like an older chemical. You're like, yeah, I can't yeah. get the slip anymore.
Yeah, I'm all,
like you said,
you know, on Facebook all the time, or you know, there's a few different groups on there where people are selling equipment or supplies or whatever, and occasionally you'll see where someone is retiring or somebody's passed away and their family member is trying to liquidate all their stuff, and you'll see, you know, them offering chemicals, you know, like the Albany slip, you know, that you can't get anymore. And you know, if it's close enough and feasible enough, I'll certainly inquire about it. But a lot of times, it, you know, my luck, it's, you know, across the country or something, and can't take advantage of it. But yeah, certainly chemicals. Clay would probably be a different thing, because you just don't, you know, somebody, you know, moving that stuff around is so hard, you know, shipping. And but like I said, if it's close enough, sure, it'll pique my interest and I'll look into it.
I really like that type of stuff. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm so drawn to bonsai, because of the collectability. And when you start getting deep into either like the history or the culture of your particular brand of bonsai. So like here in the South, we have our Southeastern native trees and our Southeastern potters and our stand makers and so on and so forth. And so when you get so niche, and then you get these like micro communities of people who are looking for certain things like that, like rare glazes, slips, clay bodies, components and all that stuff, I actually think that's really awesome. And those are the kind of conversations I really like to have with people, is, oh, so this is uncommon, or you can't find this. How do I get a piece of yeah. pottery with that component in it? Because I would love to nerd out and tell somebody, oh, there's a deep story, because I usually like to tell long stories about that, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, there's potters I'd like to have pots of that either aren't producing anymore or aren't around anymore that, you know, wish I had, or wish I'd taken the opportunity to get one when I could have, but I didn't. And so, yeah, that that always comes up. And always kind of looking for pots as well, even though I make a ton of pots. I'm seeing that rare pot that I'd love to have in my collection from somebody that's not around anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty crazy the way that that the collector's brain kind of function is. Like, I have access to so many trees and so many plants, but if somebody has something that's unique or different and they're like, hey, would you like to trade or would you like this? I mean, I can't turn it down. it's so funny how that works. It's like, okay, well, I have a good handful of trees and project plants. Would I like another one? Of course, you know? Sure. And so it's fun. It's nice to hear that, like, you have the same quote unquote issue being a potter and still taking in pieces.
Well, I had the same issue with trees as well when I started bonsai, and I was like, oh, I don't have one of those. I want one of those, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And of course, some of them suffered because of it, because they wouldn't grow in, you know, this latitude and so forth. So, live and learn.
I mean, yeah, it's part of the collection and the passion of it is an obsession. That's what I've been told with some people with bonsai. It's just like, okay, well, I need that. So, but beyond just the absolute, like, just needing pots and trees, I was that kind of sprung a question in my mind. I was like thinking, so you're inspired by a lot of pieces that you've seen in the past. And so I wanted to know what your favorite potter, non-bonsai related, would have been early on. Like, who did you look up to? I know that's probably a tough question.
Hamada, if you know that name, a Japanese potter, his last name was Hamada, and he passed in the, I think in the 70s, late 70s, passed away. Bernard Leach is another one. Warren McKenzie, American Pioneer. Bernard Leach was English. But they were you know, mostly functional potters. And that's kind of where my background began. It was functional pottery and what I did all for the longest time. I didn't really get interested into bonsai. I mean, it caught my interest at an early age. I'm going to say, when I was in college, I don't remember where or exactly how, but I saw a tree or somewhere and, was interested. But, gosh, this was way before the internet and there wasn't, periodicals or anything like that, even that I was aware of, and there probably was, but not in South Mississippi. My interest in bonsai didn't peak again till when I met Jennifer, my wife, and she grew up in California, and we went out there to visit and went to a friend's house that she was new and walked in the backyard and there were a couple of bonsai trees sitting there.
Anyway.
And as it turned out, this person's mother had passed and she was had practiced bonsai, and so he had taken these trees from her. Unfortunately, he didn't not know how to take care of them, and we went back a year later, they were all dead. But anyway, that spurred my interest, and then of course there was a lot of more information, and I began to research, and that's where naturally being needing pots, where am I gonna get pots? I'm gonna make pots. So that's where I started making bonsai pots, or when I started making bonsai pots. And that was about probably 20 years ago.
Yeah. And so on top of roughly about 30 years of knowledge of how ceramics work and how to, you know, in functional pottery, and then you added on another 20 years of bonsai pottery. That's still a lot of time. And it's clear, like, from if you, and for our listeners, if you pick up a piece of Byron of Myrick pottery, I usually refer to your pieces as Byron pottery, because I know you pretty well now. I've been talking to you for a while. So, but yeah, if you pick up a piece of Myrick pottery and you just hold the pieces in your hand, you kind of feel how the pieces are made, and you look at the bottoms and you see like how you set up the holes and the feet, and everything is so well refined. Even like the rougher, more intentionally like looser pieces, I can tell when you're doing something, you're like a little bit more, your intention is a little bit more laid back with the piece. The refined, it's still very highly refined. It has the drainage holes and the tie down holes, and the bottom is nice and flat, and the walls are, you know, everything is so well put together there. But yeah, you can tell there's a lot of care there in your pieces, that you clean them up and everything. And I mean, I can imagine you seem very methodical in the way that you work with your pieces, as far as like throw, hand build, and then dry, and then clean them up. I'm sure you go through a lot of sanding, that I know from the times that I've worked with clay, the sanding process seems so tedious, but it seems like you probably revel in that.
Yeah, actually, that's the part I don't like.
Oh.
I like to try to get it finished so that I don't have to sand. But anyway, there's that spot that gets away from you, or you made us a little sanding takes place. But yeah, of the process, that's the one I dislike the most, is sanding. It is a process, and I have kind of a schedule that I call it a schedule anyway. I throw, and then the pieces have to dry to a certain extent. So while they're drying, I may be mixing glazes or glazing something or whatever, getting ready for a firing. And then when they're ready to, they're dry enough to work on, then I go back to working on those and, adding feet, adding drain holes, putting together whatever, big or particularly ovals, those are made in two pieces. The collar or the walls are thrown, and then that's shaped into an oval, and then the bottom added. Whereas a round piece, generally, I throw the bottom in the piece and then throw the walls. And so that's all one piece, except I might add, the feet to it. Sometimes the feet are carved out of the bottom. But other times they may be added on to the bottom. So it just depends on the process. But yeah, it's all, as the clay dries, it becomes, as you work with it, it becomes firmer and more resilient to the touch. And so along that way, that journey there, you do different things to it to smooth it out or refine edges or whatever you need to do.
Yeah. So that just means that your process is very, like you said, you avoid having to do extra work. So do the same thing. I mean, you know how things should be over all the years that you've done it. Like you said, throwing a collar for a pot and cutting it off, and then having your slab roller, which I've seen, and not a lot of potters that I especially when I talk to younger potters are getting into it, slab rollers are like a luxury item for potters. So having that just to line everything up properly and roll out your pieces to like what you need, that makes the process a lot smoother and easier as well, I'm sure. But yeah, marrying those collars to the bottom and stuff, that's a whole thing on its own. But when you've been doing it for so long, as long as you have, I'm sure it's just as easy as, easy as pouring the cup of coffee as you work on the pieces too. So do you enjoy throwing ovals and stretching them out, or do you like making rounds? Which one do you prefer?
I probably make, I'm going to say three times as many ovals as I do rounds. people tend to be drawn more to the ovals. If I had 10 ovals and five rounds sitting on a table at a vending event, I'd probably sell maybe eight of the ovals and three or four of the rounds, So I tend to make more ovals as a result. And I've kind of got in and got into doing some of those soft rectangles, which are basically ovals that are not ovals. They're squared off and corners to them rather than, but same process as doing an oval, making a collar and then squaring it off rather than making it oval.
Yep. And that's something I actually get a young potter every once in a while will kind of hit me up and they'll ask me, oh, so I'm trying to get into bonsai pottery. What do you guys like? And I always tell them, like, we just can't, like you said, can't get enough oval shaped pots. You see round pots and for days, because that's where a lot of potters start. You have to learn how to make a cylinder.
And yeah, then, they're easier to make.
Yeah. And once you get your cylinder down, that's your bread and butter, because quick cylinders, that's one of the things I love the most about collecting pottery from different people is having a coffee cup, because that's like the first thing you learn how to make in pottery. And if you can make a good cylinder, you can make a good coffee cup. And also, I love coffee. But I tell them as well, I'm like, if you could get the process to make ovals or squares, and I mean, it's not all that difficult once you kind of transfer your ability to make a good cylinder into an oval, because I mean, the walls of the bonsai containers are usually not too high anyway. So it's not as tedious as throwing like a tall vessel or something, like a vase. But yeah, I'm always telling people that get into pottery, I'm like, make ovals and put at least, you got minimum is two drainage holes in your oval, and I guarantee you people will buy it, you know? Yeah. The glazes could be like, what's that called? Your glazes could shiver. Is that the correct terminology for it?
That's when it falls off the plate.
Yeah, that's, like they could be like that. Like I've seen people actually pick up a pot where the glazes fall like that, and they're like, oh, that's unique, I'll buy this. I've actually seen glazes like that be successful on pots if they're still oval, you know? So that's always been something.
Crackle is probably what you're looking for when you get the fine lines.
Yeah.
And the glaze.
Like an intentional, like almost like shattered glass almost feel to it.
Yeah, it's kind of, the crazing is another term for crazing or crackle. Yeah. Shivering is really where the glaze doesn't fit the clay and they shrink at different rates and the glaze pops off of the clay. That's not something you want to happen.
Yeah, and usually in ceramics, yeah, that's seen as like a huge flaw. But I've seen ceramicists in bonsai pottery use that almost as like a way to make a pot have like a weird weathered or otherworldly feel.
Yeah. It will happen in weather sometimes when you're, if you've got a clay that's not vitrified and it gets some real cold weather and the clay kind of has absorbed a lot of moisture, you'll see it a lot with more expensive imported pieces, clay bodies or pots. And then when it freezes, that outer layer will pop off. And then it really does look weathered.
Yeah, because like you said, it's not bonded or fit to the clay body like it properly should. So is that something you would recommend, is use more local sources then?
Well, as far as the pod and the clay you're talking about?
Yeah, like if somebody wanted to get into it, instead of buying other stuff from outside sources.
You want a vitrified clay, which means that it doesn't absorb moisture. It's more glass like. It's reached its maximum vitrification so that it doesn't absorb any moisture. You know, with bonsai pots, you're watering them every day most of the time, and several times a day. So if it absorbs moisture, and of course, if you're in a warm climate, if you're down in South Florida, it doesn't matter so much. But if you're up north somewhere and then you get that cold freeze and you have moisture in the clay, that will freeze and that will rupture or crack the clay body. My recommendation for anybody making bonsai pots is to try to get a clay body that vitrifies at whatever temperature you're firing at. And so that you cover all your bases there, from warm climate to cold climate. You never know where that pot's going, you know. You may sell it to – I see stuff of mine sold on Facebook that, somebody in Louisiana may have bought that somebody in Michigan may buy, you know. So it's going from a warm climate to a cold climate, and you want to make sure that that pot is going to stay together through that cold winter in Michigan just as well as it would in Louisiana.
Oh, hey, Carmen, did I tell you about Bonsai Central yet?
No, I don't think you have.
Oh, I think I might have mentioned it a few other times, but it's going to be May 3rd through 5th in 2024 in St. Louis, Missouri. It's basically the national show, but it's going to be Central America, and it's going to be an awesome show with cash awards and prizes. There's going to be a professional bonsai show and a kusumono show as well.
Ooh.
With the presentation during dinner with for rewards and whatnot. But if you want to submit a tree, I think you have to submit 2 to 4 photos, and you need a brief description of your tree and send it over to the contact form at bonsaicentral.com. That's bonsai-central.com. But I think there's going to be vendors there, too. Do you know what vendors were included? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I heard that it's going to be something like 25 plus of the best vendors from around the country. So, like, including nurseries, potters, stand makers, tool suppliers, and all of that.
But, like, specifically, I thought I heard that there was going to be American potters, like...
Oh, yeah. Totally, yeah. Now, Toshu Take is going to be there, Vicky Chamberlain, Eli Atkins of Waldo Street Pottery, Abel Grigsby, Roy Minari, and Byron Merrick. Sellers of imported Japanese and antique Chinese pots are going to be there, too.
That's amazing. I mean, there must be, like, a pretty good lineup for this show as far as, like... They're headliners. There should be some really good bonsai artists. Do you have any idea who that might be? I think I might have heard about Bjorn, but there's some other ones, right?
Oh, yeah. Bjorn's going to be there. Tyler Sherrod as well. Maria Hayek. Andrew Robson. Mauro Stemberger. And Young Cho.
Oh.
I think there's going to be workshops, show walkthroughs, critiques, all that stuff.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. There should be somewhere to go on bonsai-central.com, and you can fill out the opportunities to do workshops with these professionals. They have really great material, I've heard. It's going to be stuff like twisted junipers and old fused maples and really awesome pieces of material for Young's kusumono class. So I think if you guys are interested, y'all should go check out bonsai-central.com and see if you can register for the show, sign up for workshops if they're still available. But I'll definitely be there this year.
Awesome. That's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Bonsai Central, for sponsoring our show.
Hey, everyone. This is John Eads, founder of Left Coast Bonsai and proud supporter of the Little Things for Bonsai People podcast. I'm breaking into your feed today to let you know about a few exciting things we're doing here at Left Coast Bonsai. We're a small, family-owned bonsai nursery that's focused on producing high-quality bonsai plant material, as well as sourcing hard-to-find supplies for growing in your own yard. For many of us, winter is a time to pause and reflect on the year ahead. Now's a good time to decide what seedlings and supplies you need for the upcoming season. We have a large selection of seedlings that will begin shipping out mid-February for our spring season. You can also order baskets, felt bags, or aluminum wire. In addition to the seedlings and supplies, I also teach classes and study groups on a broad range of subjects, including growing trees from scratch. I hope to hear from you soon and would love to talk about how we can support your bonsai growing journey. You can find us online at leftcoastbonsai.com, on Instagram at Left Coast Bonsai, or send me an email at talk@leftcoastbonsai.com. Cheers!
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
That's a unique thing to kind of think about, because whenever I work on trees and I've grown a tree from cutting or from seed, and it comes out the field, and then I work it into pre-bonsai phase, and then someone will buy it from me, and I see it go off to somewhere else, and I'm always like, it's a living thing, so there's a chance that if the person is skilled enough, they can keep it alive, and I would love to see that tree again. And then in some cases, I know when I see a tree go, I'm like, okay, I'll probably, there's a high chance I won't see that again, you know? Yeah. So I had to kind of come to terms with that. But with your pots, bonsai pottery doesn't have the opportunity to die. It more has the opportunity to crack. That must be something that you'll see some of your pots go on. And I mean, I guess that's the highest, that's just a quality concern to you. Is there any other concerns when you send out your pottery to the world, or is there any other thoughts you have on that?
Well, I hadn't thought too much about that other than, you know, you certainly want it to survive. You don't want, you know, a flaw in it. And I have had a couple of pots I made for a guy that he planted a big, some big ball cypress in them. And those things, as you know, they grow so fast, the root system. And then it froze as well, and it busted the pot. I mean, it was you know, tight roots, and then the freeze as well. Yeah. And it busted. And so, you know, things like that, you hate to hear them. You know, you hate to hear of pots breaking, even, you know, getting people get in touch, and, you know, a windstorm came through and blew some of my trees over, and, you know, your pot, one of your pots got broken or things like that. And you hate to hear it, but it happens. And that's just the way it goes. But, you know, it could happen with anybody's pots. I've seen some, really high quality imported stuff, Chinese and Japanese pots break from roots busting them, you know, or it became so pot bound that it would crack the pot. So it's something that you know, you need to repot occasionally, and particularly if you got one that's really aggressive growing.
I tell people, especially with the bald cypress, is that I don't generally let their roots freeze solid, you know, for multiple reasons. Like, because of that was that issue with the pot. I've got trees in my own collection where I'll have it in one of your containers, and I know the tree will be fine, but at the same time, I got to wrap the roots and the pot, because, I mean, like you said, it's the value in that is it's a timeless thing. Like, if you keep your pot nice for a long time, and then, I mean, you'll still have that container it could outlast your tree easily. So I just hold that so much more value in protecting those containers. It's kind of surprising to me. Every once in a while, I'll hear the horror story of like a hailstorm coming through and chipping pots and stuff too. And there's not so much you can do with that as far as clay bodies go, but I find your containers are tough. Like, I've seen people clack them against things, or something in my yard will hit it, and they hold up pretty solid. And that might come from like the cone that you fire at too, as far as having them as solid as that goes, right?
Yeah, you want to, like I say, that vitrification, that temperature where it becomes as dense as possible, and it makes it stronger. And and in a lot of ways, it can make it more fragile, but it certainly, with water and intrusion, things like that, it makes it stronger. It being a little more, I make the term glass like, but it is kind of getting closer to glass. I mean, you can heat clay enough where it, you can actually, it will melt and become more like glass. So the closer you get to that, you begin to lose some integrity too, particularly from knocks and, you know, something hitting that's harder than it is, you know, a steel object, for instance, hitting the side of the pot can be more danger to it. It's higher vitrified that as it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
You know, you mentioned like,
you drop something on a concrete floor, it's going to break.
Yeah. If you have like a steel anvil versus concrete floor, like you're kind of, yeah, the way you can think of it, yeah.
Pot versus concrete floor, you know, the pot's going to lose.
Yep. Just kind of which container or more like which object is tougher at that point.
Exactly.
I like how you mentioned like if you could overfire a pot. And I mean, a lot of people like don't think about this very often, but like when a volcano, like how hot those can be, it melts rocks. And that's kind of like where we're at with the clay bodies. We're bringing it to a temperature where you could overdo it, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's another thing. You can certainly, I mean, clays have a point where they, you know, they reach that vitrification, high vitrification, and then they start going the other way. And the sign of that usually in a clay, finished clay, is that you'll get it looks like bubbles forming on the inside the clay. I mean, you'll see a little bump on the side of the clay or the side of the pot, or you might see multiples, and that's gas forming inside the clay that's expanding it at that high temperature. And
those would probably blow up in the kiln more often, if I had to bet.
No, well, usually blowing up happens at lower temperature. That happens at very high temperature. And blowing up is usually caused by, I use the term local water, water that is in the clay just, you know, from hadn't dried properly or enough.
Damn.
And then you put it in the kiln and it starts heating. That moisture in there can't get out fast enough, and with the heat rise, and it basically turns to steam inside the clay, and then it's got to get out of there, and that's when it blows up.
Yeah,
and you open your kiln up after it cools off, and there's a pile of shard there where your pot used to be.
Yeah, it could be quite disastrous too if it blows and pings off of things
I've seen it where it's just literally almost looks like cat litter there.
It just like blows to little pieces.
Yeah, it just shatters it into oblivion, and then sometimes it'll just pop out a big chunk of the wall or something.
But
I found that if you let it dry, or if you fire the beginnings are slow enough, let it dry out, then you can usually avoid that.
And just so for our listeners, we'll know how you fire your containers. You use electric kiln.
I use electric to bis fire. That's the first firing. That takes them up to 1,850 degrees, and then you cool it off, take the pot out, then you apply the glaze. And I have two. I do fire some electric, but I have a gas kiln.
Oh,
well, cool. And it fires with propane, in the one I have. And I live in the country, so I don't have city gas or commercial gas available. And that way I use hot fire with propane. So fire both techniques. It depends on whether I want to. I don't do a heavy reduction in my gas kiln, but it's just something that I don't like relying on. Reduction is if, well, again, kind of nerding out here, it's a firing technique where you fire, and as you get up to the temperature where the glaze melts, you cut down on the oxygen supply or reduce the oxygen in the kiln, and it creates a heavy carbon atmosphere inside the kiln, and that changes some of the chemical reaction in the glazes and can cause color shifts and the colors that you would get in oxidation. Oxidation is when you have sufficient oxygen present, and then reduction is you're reducing the oxygen. So oxidation, you always get the same results. Reduction, you can get varied results, even within the same kiln and the same firing.
And so, also, the pieces will be varied, too, like if they're in different spots of the kiln, too.
Exactly. Yeah. And so when you try to get some consistency, then it becomes more difficult. If you're trying to get a certain color, and you got three pots in there that you want the same color, and you get one of them, it comes out that color, it becomes a little annoying. So I just kind of formulate my colors and glazes to fire in oxidation. And I'll get some reduction in that gas kiln from time to time in different places and get some color shifts. But it's not something I target.
Okay. Yeah, I for some reason I was under the impression that you did mostly electric, but the next time I come to your house and look at your shop, I would like to see your gas setup. I didn't know about that. Do you ever do any soda or salt firing, or is that too much?
The reason for I have done it in the past, and I got a little kill out there that I built for soda firing, but it's out of commission right now, and I haven't used it in a while. I keep thinking that I'll get it back in working order and fire it some more, but I always stay too busy to get that done. But anyway, back to you. I don't, because kilns that are used for that are kind of designated for that. Those materials, particularly salt, when you do a salt firing, and I'll try to make this as brief as possible, you're actually injecting, when you get the kiln up to temperature, you're injecting salt into the kiln. And that high temperature volatilizes salt, and the sodium in the salt attacks the clay body. Well, what is the kiln made out of? Brick.
Yes,
which is made out of clay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's attacking that kiln as well. So it covers the walls of the kiln just like it does the pot.
Yeah.
So in other words, that reaction on the pot that makes the salt glaze, it's also salting the inside of your kiln. So every time you fire that kiln, that salt revolatilizes.
And
you get a salt firing,
yeah,
whether you want it or not. And it eventually erodes the kiln, and you have to tear the kiln down and rebuild it.
Yeah,
soda does the same thing to a certain degree, not quite as aggressively as salt does, but it does react the same way. Short answer, no, I don't do salt.
Yeah.
Unless I'm invited to a wood firing. A lot of wood fire people do saltings or soda firing in their kilns, and occasionally I get invited to wood fire, and I'll take a few pieces and put in there, and they may get salt fired. I think you got a piece that was wood fired from me not long ago, a little piece.
I've got two pieces. It was a nautical piece and then a soft, like, rectangle
Yeah, it was a smaller piece that the last wood fire that I went to.
Yeah, and that was one thing that I was I try to stress to people when they look at those pieces, because some people who are not like pottery heads, where they look at these ceramics and some people look at it and they go, oh, well, that's a piece of pottery. But whenever they see a wood fired piece, and I'm like, look at the glaze, feel the pot, feel how that feels different from this over here. And some people don't make that connection, but people who know ceramics instantly can look at a wood fired piece and go, this has variance. This has varying levels of like reduction that only comes from wood firing, and different glaze patterning and stuff, and even like the burn marks sometimes. That's some of the coolest looking stuff, and people don't realize how rare that could be sometimes, because setting up a wood firing process is not the easiest thing in the world. Because I remember you told me the last time you did one, and I'm aware of this, but for the listeners to know, it takes like people and shifts, like potters and shift, to keep the fire going.
Right.
And so when you build it up, are you guys doing, like, y'all have like a big temperature gauge on it, or is it just by like looking at the cones and seeing how the cones fold over? How's that usually monitored?
Oh, both. You put pyrometers in there, and they're just probes that go into the kiln through the wall that usually you won't. At least a couple, you know, different parts of the kiln. Some people may have four or five or six, but of these probes, and they just hook up to almost like a multimeter kind of a device that it plugs into, and it will read the temperature. And so you can take and just have one device, but several probes, and just move that device around and check different probes and see how the temperature is going. But you also want cones in there, and as I know you know, but again, cones are devices that are manufactured. Did I say device? It's a little, it's made out of ceramic material that you can buy according to the temperature you want to fire to. And you put several of these in there, which are indicators of the progression of the heat. And so most potters will use both. So they'll use the pyrometers, the mechanical device, and the cones, the more chemical device, to see what the kiln is doing and how it's progressing. And yep. Then you just monitor those. And a lot of people in wood fire, you know, have an idea. Some people will do it as quickly as they can, and then some people draw it out as long as they can, you know, in other words, days, maybe. The first may fire a wood kiln in a day, you know, and within a 24-hour period. Some people may draw it out to 5 or 6 or 7 days.
Cool.
That do it seven, well, let me go back. The ones that do it a day, they're more after just the heat, and they're not going to get a lot of effect of the wood. Those that draw it out for a long time will get a lot of wood effect. And what I mean by that is that the ash and all collects on the pieces over a long period of time versus the short period of time. And that collects on pots depending on their position. And think of the fire as like water flowing through the kiln. It begins on one end and goes out the other. And it's taking stuff with it, almost like sediment in water. It's taking ashes and particles with it, and then those hit the pots, and then it affects the glaze and forms its own glaze in some cases. That's where
the high variance comes from.
The term wood ash glaze, that's where it really originated from, is wood firing. Today we kind of take wood ash and use it as a component and mix it in glaze and put it on pots and get some of the same effects or near like effect. But you can never reproduce a wood firing any other way than wood firing.
Yeah.
Kind of mimic it a little bit to some extend, but the real look of it comes only through, you know, the time in the heat process.
I mean, is it considered in some circles to be cheating a little bit if you don't, if you're like a hardcore potter and you're like, if you don't wood fire and you use ash glazes?
Well, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you don't have a black pine, you're not a bonsai artist, or if you don't have a white pine.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, kind of same thing, you know, it's like, well, I only do wood firing, so, or I only do this kind of firing, or reduction firing, or only do oxidation. So yeah, there's different camps, but as long as you make a good product and cover all your bases there, then it really doesn't matter, other than if you want wood fired pots, then you're gonna have to seek out wood fired potters.
Yeah, I'm guessing there's going to be people who are very purists, like that the only way is either a wood fire kiln or like you said, like gas firing. And because a lot of the higher quality stuff, people refer to gas firing. They say it's always expensive and it's difficult to set those things up, especially in home studios. They're a little bit more rare to see have that kind of thing. So
you touched on young potters a while ago about equipment and all. That's, you know, being in the game as long as I have, that's certainly, you know, you get a wheel and then you get a kill, and then, you know, if you may get an extruder, then you get a slab roller, and all this stuff is, you know, terribly expensive now. I used to think it was expensive, but after COVID hit and everybody wanted to become a potter, all of a sudden it's the price of everything is doubled and tripled, and so it's, you know, become unaffordable to a lot of people. But you just have to build up slowly and you know, make enough stuff to buy this, or, you know, buy that or whatever, kind of reinvest your money into it, and then once you get everything, then it all kind of becomes more profitable. I'm not gonna say it's all profit, because you still have to buy clay and lasers and fuel and all that, you know, either whether it's electricity or propane or wood or whatever you're buying. It's all become more expensive.
With the state of things now, with how pottery has become more popular, like you said, and people are getting, they're either getting into it and finding that, like you said, they're priced out of it, or they're so passionate enough that they're just going to make it work. Do you think it'll be feasible? Will you think it'll be realistic in the next couple of generations for potters? Will that be a career?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think, you know, those that are passionate enough are going to find a way, whether it's, you know, buying used stuff or reconditioned stuff that they can find. You know, I find a lot of, I probably spend too much time on Facebook prowling around, but a lot of different groups, and you can find people that are buying wheels that are 50 years old that are reconditioning them, you know, and putting new, you know, tear them apart, sanding them down, repainting them, putting new components in there, the ones that don't work, bearings or whatever, and putting them back together in order to have a working wheel. And they may have, you know, a few hundred dollars in it, you know, less than 500 maybe, rather than going and paying $1,500 for a new wheel. And so those type of people will continue and prosper, and then they're those that are, for whatever reason, can afford the new equipment, and they will as well. Where there's a will, there's a way.
Yep. That's what I was kind of wondering. It's like, I know it's like the scary thing of the future of technology and all that, and will people hold that type of stuff in value in the future? And you see careers like blacksmithing is no longer a feasible thing. I mean, some people do get successful in blacksmithing is like a one of those like old school kind of trade kind of things, but you got to be in a really specialized place for that type of stuff, or fabrication type guys that make things out of metal or you know. And so ceramics kind of falls into that unique kind of thing. Like it's been around for centuries, and it's more artistic than it is, you know, completely necessary in day-to-day life, because you just go to your local Walmart, Target, or wherever and buy pots and plates and stuff.
Exactly.
So it's just kind of like, you know, where is ceramics going to be in the next generation, you know? And I'm really hoping people will continue to engage in it. I think bonsai pottery is a very special way for potters to engage with their medium, because I think bonsai pottery is very demanding. As far as, I mean, like when you get clientele asking you for custom pieces, and people are very picky, and every tree is so different and stuff, I'm sure that helps that out too.
Yeah, it's particularly the commission piece can be quite daunting sometimes. I enjoy doing them, and I think for the most part, things I make people are happy with. Occasionally, you know, my vision and somebody else's vision differ, and so we have to maybe restart, so to speak, and do another piece to get our visions together. But I enjoy working with people that order stuff. I enjoy doing, you know, just making stuff and then vending it. I think that's something that I really enjoy, going to shows and meeting new people and seeing people that I, you know, have met at a show 4 years ago or whatever, or did an event at their club or whatever, you know, people all over the country that I would have never known except through my pottery and doing that. If I had just got into bonsai and had a few trees and never started the pot end of it, you know, it would have been a whole different experience for me.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed this ride, so to speak.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that you really don't get to appreciate or see that you mentioned there, is like you could make all these pots and not know if your work is any good enough to sell, and you don't go to a show, and you have these anxieties about going out. But I think exposing yourself more to these shows and over time and seeing other people's work or talking to people who want to buy your pieces, and it gives you a better idea, and it gives you the commodity in being at a show is much more valuable than worrying about what you're going to sell your pieces for, in my opinion. And so like that's kind of like my thing with vending too, is I'll have all my plants and my stuff that I'm going to bring to a show, and I don't have those anxieties anymore, because I'm looking forward to that, you know, that hanging out and talking to people. Like you said, it's so awesome. Like that environment is, it's a different, it's a game changer whenever you go in. And I mean, I used to get really, really anxious whenever I would have to go present. Like, for instance, over here where I'm doing my lectures and stuff, I used to be terrified of speaking in front of people. That would never happen, you know? And now it's like, I'd rather not be anywhere else. So it's kind of like you get that awesome feeling of being in the vendor area and working it. And you and your vendor buddies get little things, that little stories and jokes and stuff that you get to revisit. That makes it its own special thing. I love that about bonsai too. It's because it's super niche, and you know, everybody's there for bonsai, and it's almost impossible not to make a new friend, because you guys are all into the same thing.
I've got those couple of shows I've got coming up that looking forward to. Is there, you know, one thing I'm looking forward to, there are a few potters that I haven't met there that are going to be vending there as well. So that's always something I look forward to is meeting the new people that haven't met before. Mm. And so
pick their brain a little bit.
You know, yeah, like you say, getting, you know, you get four or five fighters together and talking shop, and it's always fun. And you know, you may pick up something somebody says that you know, like, oh, I hadn't thought about that, you know, and
yep,
may lead you down a new path that you hadn't realized was there.
Like I've always said on the show, it's like I believe that Bonsai should be very community based, because I mean, way back in the day, whenever Bonsai was being popularized in Japan, it did start out as kind of a higher tier type art form, but whenever it started stepping down into like the local markets and stuff, then it became more community based, and tastes and trends and stuff started actually coming up. People could start talking about things. The same is true with Bonsai pottery circles too, I'm sure. So yeah, that's super important, guys. So like if you're a listener and you're a Bonsai inspiring potter, I think that's one of the things I would recommend is get your work out there. Go to a Bonsai club and start talking to people and get your pots into the hands of people who love Bonsai and see what they think, what their take is. But yeah, we're getting close to the end here. We're running pretty long on this one, but it's always good to catch up with you and talk, so I don't mind it. But just to kind of close out the episode, kind of give us a few quick things that you would recommend to potters who are looking to get into Bonsai pottery. What's a couple of pieces of advice you would like to kind of share with us to get us towards the end here?
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, get good solid technique, whatever you're going to do, whether it's hand building or throwing or whatever, just, you know, practice your craft and your process, and make sure that you got that down pat. Look at a lot of pots. Look and, you know, study, you know, old pots, new pots. You know, find out what makes a good bonsai pot as far as the drainage, wire holes. I mean, you'll find some old pots that you know, are antiques that were not really made for a bonsai. They adapted them to that, and you know, you may not find wire holes in them, but you'll find today that people expect that. So find out what the anatomy of the pot is that makes it a good pot and is going to be desirable you know, to your client, or you know, the public that's looking at your product. And then just, you know, start making, and then do what you can, making connections to get in events, or, you know, find a local club that might let you come give a talk and show your wares to, and you just slowly build up that way. I mean, the first time I sold any pots, I was selling out of the back of my truck at another event that
Amen.
And just, you know, just kind of grew from there, and people started word kind of spread, and people started buying them, and then got invited here and there and so forth. So
yeah,
it takes a little time. It's not a quick process, but it can be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to find that spark, and then you kind of build it up, like you're saying. That's the only way to do it, is just to like get on the grind and start working and start exposing your work. That's
exactly. Yeah.
There you go. But yeah, thanks for hanging out and talking pots with me. And
I know.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's always really
going to talk pottery with you.
Yeah, I love nerding out about pottery. I love learning the process and what makes certain pots and glazes special, because like I said, I love that those little tiny things, the little details that that makes a pot special, and that makes it, you know, I need that, you know. I could show a pot in it, and then I mean, I could show a bonsai in a pot, and then if I'm like looking at that pot and I'm like, that's that tree's in here because of that minor little detail, because Byron told me that that's how that process or how that glaze works. That just makes that connection to that tree and that whole composition so much better for me. So yeah, I just wanted people to kind of hear my brain thoughts versus how a professional bonsai potter kind of like reflects on those thoughts too. So it's a really good conversation each time. So,
well, I enjoy it anytime.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, we'll be seeing you at Save Bonsai. I'll be seeing you at the Texas Convention and at Bonsai Central. So it's good. We're going to be seeing each other a good bit here coming up really soon. So looking forward to seeing you at Save Bonsai. And thanks for being on the show this week, Byron.
Well, glad you had me on. Thanks again.
Yep. All right. And for our listeners, we'll be talking to you guys next week.